I'm Gary Marks. I teach sociology within and beyond universities. I spent a wonderful month in China, perhaps the best month of my life beyond one I spent in New Jersey some time ago. When I went to China, it was very much as an explorer and not as a colonizer. It's the same principle which I would like to have animate this discussion. I would like it to be one in which we can mutually learn from each other. There's a wonderful Chinese expression which says, may you live in interesting times. Clearly, with respect to issues of computers and society, as the internet explodes throughout China and indeed Asia, that is happening. I have in my hand four pages of more than 100 questions that I think we ought to ask about the social, ethical, policy, cultural, historical implications of any new technology. I'd be happy to send those to anyone to whom they may be of interest. And those questions animate my concerns with this topic today. Let me have demonstrate a couple of images. This is a bad image, thank you. There's a famous New Yorker cartoon which says, the scientific community is divided. Some say this stuff is dangerous, some say it isn't. Seems to me one might say the same thing about the policy community and the cultural analysis community. We in the West take it for granted that individualism is a very high value, that privacy should be protected and be prioritized. Other societies are not so sure. And I think the issue of privacy, individualism, community is very much what in fact is involved here. There, in fact, in the Chinese language is not an English equivalent for our term of privacy. Privacy, as I understand it, has even a slightly antisocial connotation to it, that things that are done not in full view or they're hidden, it's not somehow quite appropriate. The images are sort of international. Here we have a human in the robotic arm, and you know, the issue is, you know, are they shaking hands in a genuine grasp? Is the robotic arm controlling and overwhelming the human? Are they somehow merged so you can't tell where the human stops and the other one begins? I was in Belgium a couple years ago and went to a wonderful technology conference. Being disrespectful of private property, I stole a sign from the conference after it was over. Maybe this, anyway. Can I enlarge it? Okay. It says, technology for a better world. And it shows a robotic arm holding flowers. And the issue there, of course, is the robotic arm cradling, protecting, lovingly engaging the flowers, or is it crushing the flowers? I thought this had a lot to do with sort of Western images. That's a classic representation from Western art, as you know. And then I was in the month I spent in China, I came across this little gem, which is hard to see, but it's a Casio ad for every variety of chip impregnated device that we know, and probably some we don't, and it says, you know, in Chinese going down, electronic technology creates a beautiful future. And the question for us today is, to what extent and under what conditions, but is it correct that electronic technology creates a beautiful future? The questions that I've put to our panelists have to do with issues involving access, content, security, freedom of expression, privacy, and property. The developing countries also face some rather unique issues, particularly if they haven't institutionalized Western notions of individual liberty. What happens to local cultures in the face of strong media that come from a very different kind of society? The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, in a recent expression of solidarity, made very clear their reservations about the internet. For example, the Indonesian Information Minister Harmoko said, the impact of these new technologies on society has to be seriously taken care of. And now there's ambiguities in language, but it's important to understand what does it mean to seriously take care of these. But some issues that apply clearly are, can a society have a competitive economic development without permitting the freedom of expression made possible by new information technologies? Will what the jargon calls horizontal means of communication, such as the Internet, lead to the weakening of centralized government control and commercial control, even of national borders? What laws and policies are likely to govern Internet use? About a month ago, a new directive was issued in China which required all, we have to have a driver's license, we have to register with the police. If we drive a car here in China, you must register with the police according to the new directive in order to use the Internet. And that is the beginning of a series of regulations and policies that we will be seeing. What are the consequences of those? What's the link between the content or the quality of a rule and the ability to implement it? To what extent are efforts to control the Internet simply symbolic and statements of what those with power see as desirable as against mechanisms that can literally and easily be enforced? In the case of Hong Kong, what will happen to traditional civil liberties and privacy expectations when Hong Kong returns to China in 1997? And I think we have to ask, what are the likely impacts, social impacts of the Internet on China? But particularly important for us in the West with our chauvinism and our narrow perspective, how will the Chinese Internet affect the outside world? How will what happens there impact upon us? Because it is clearly reciprocal. Our panel will, you know, explore these issues. We'll move from a particular description of the Internet in China to some of the broader issues. Let me introduce the panelists. Professor Xin Li from Tsinghua University is Vice Director of CERNET, which is the Chinese Academic Education and Research Network. And he's been a central figure in the development of the Chinese Internet for academic purposes. Professor Zhaqing Fang, also from Tsinghua University, is a philosopher and a sociologist who specializes in issues of science and technology with an interest in communications technology. Professor Milton Mueller, Rutgers University, has done extensive research on telecommunications in China. He's the author of the forthcoming book, China Enters the Information Age. Mark Berthold is Senior Crown Counsel. He played a central role in a very interesting law reform commission of Hong Kong, a report and legislation that was recently passed. Professor Raymond Wax from the University of Hong Kong, a law professor, is the author of many books, including Personal Information, Privacy, and the Law, which was in the back, perhaps has been borrowed now by one of our conference attendees. And finally, it's a pleasure to introduce and to welcome Professor Wei Hongshen, who is the sitting in front here. He is the director of the Institute of Science, Technology, and Society at Tsinghua University. He's author of a very large number of books and articles, most recently on systems theory. He's prepared a paper that deals with observations on information technology and management transformation. I want to give you a two-sentence summary of his paper, and I'll be happy to provide it to people to whom it is of interest. He notes that the structure of human society is being fundamentally changed, that China has two plans. There's CNII, China National Information Infrastructure, and the first is 1996 to 2000, and the second are the goals from 2001 to the year 2020. And in this paper, he notes four major impacts of the transformation of society based on information technologies that contrast information flows with material flows, that contrast new relations of people to each other, of people to machines, of new forms of management, centralization, decentralization, that involve new forms of interaction, feedback, systems network, new forms of modeling. And in particular, for those of us of a social bent, if not always a socialist bent, although sociology and socialism used to be seen as equivalent, he notes the transformation of organizational forms and structures that these new technologies are causing. And he asks the very important questions, which I think China, with a rich, you know, 8,000-year-old history of thinking about the meaning of life and spirituality and the search for wisdom and what it means to be a good person, and the role of sort of humanism, which in the West, with its machine gun-like industrial development, is sometimes forgotten. He asks, what are the consequences of this for human beings, and what are the implications for relationships of authority and obedience, of control and controlled? So without further running my mouth, it's a pleasure to turn the platform over to Professor Xin. And I won't introduce each speaker. And speakers will take, you know, 8 or 10 minutes, and we really welcome questions. So please.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I believe it's my honor to come. Good afternoon. And I believe it's a great honor to talk about internet in China because this conference only relates to link China to the internet besides the United States. So, how many of you have been in China? Could you please? Oh, a lot. That's good. So, maybe but I don't know if you really know internet in China or not. I can give you a little bit history of the brief introduction of China. This is a very famous internet connectivity map. And on this map, China is marked black. That means like other part of the world, besides Africa and the Middle East, China is connected to global internet. Actually, it's only happened last year. But however, because China is pretty big, if you take a look of actual, okay, this is also the number 1995. The actual number of networks connected to the old NSF net, you will see it's only 8 compared with the internet in Hong Kong, 95, and the Taiwan, 500, and the United States, okay, 28,000. So, for Chinese, there is a long way to go to get into this society. So, actually, I really appreciate and I feel I learned a lot because I'm not a government officer or a lawyer. I'm just a professor. So actually, the China is not get into this stage discuss the privacy and other issues for that. But sooner or later, definitely China will face these kind of problems. Originally, back to 1988, China, different entities connected to internet wire, XDAR25, that's some telecoms infrastructure. And actually, China, there is a Chinese saying said, wake up early, but get into market pretty late. If you see this year, okay, it's 1988. It's pretty early. And even China registered CNET. However, later Canadian network took this name, so there was a fight. Later, they put a maple leaf in between A and the net, if you really pay attention, because, but anyway, at that time, China actually used this name as a China Academic Network. But later, it's slowed down due to some, government or whatever reasons. Okay. And the current structure of internet in China is also pretty strange. At this moment, we have 5 entities connected to the global internet. The Institute of High Energy Physics, the NCFC, National Computer Facility of China, CERNET, that's the China Education Research Network, that's the entity I'm working, and Beijing University of Chemical Technology, which gets a link to Japan, Karin, and the MPT, which is the commercial internet. And it is very strange, like at this moment, there is no interconnection between those networks inside China. So actually, if somebody from MPT wants to send a mail to CERNET, it has to go to United States and back to China. So, okay, anyway, that's okay from 2 perspectives. One is, okay, definitely China set up some regulations for internet connection, but on the other hand, okay, still it's a chaos. We have a lot of space to do our own work. Yeah, that's true. Okay, for CERNET, CERNET is actually it's very like the old NSF net. We have 3 layer structure, and for our network, we divided China into 8 regions, like Beijing, Xi'an, Chengdu, Guangzhou, Wuhan,
Nanjing, Shanghai, and Shenyang, and each region is responsible for several provinces. And that's the figure for that, and the number of universities and the number of students. And the total universities in China is 1,075, and our network is trying to link all of them. Okay, our project is started by the end of 1994. And then now we have 108 universities connected to our network, so it's pretty fast. That, and also other networks is trying to get their customers. So that's why I believe the internet in China develops very fast. Okay, this is our homepage, CERNET homepage. Actually, we have two versions, one in Chinese, another in English, and it's very easy to remember, www.edu.cn. Okay, CN is the country code of China, and the EDU is educational. I believe, except Singapore, we have, like, also like Taiwan, they have this kind of structure. In Singapore, even you can find the www.sg to go to Singapore. They have a country homepage. We have, I don't know if in the United States or other countries they are going to set up www.com or whatever. But that's a good idea, right, for the surfing the internet. You won't have a starting point, at least for a country, you know where to go. Okay, that's the English homepage. The default is Chinese. The current link is pretty slow, but I'm sorry for that, but you can try. And we have lots of visitors. Okay, you can find the statistics for our homepage. You can find a lot of countries interested on our homepage. And this, okay, the original is a color plus. Currently, we have a 128 kilobit per second link, and this is the inbound, the traffic goes to China, and it's reached the limits. Back to last year, the very beginning of the establishment of this line, and this is the outbound traffic. You can see increasing and also reached the limits. So that means a lot of people interested in China and will try to visit the Chinese networks. But actually one thing is not very fair. Like for China, we connected to internet via Springlink, but we pay four circuits. Like in most of the country, I believe they connect to internet. Actually, they connect to the internet in the United States. For international link, there are two half circuits. For the telecommunication company, like you pay half circuit, the other part pay another half circuit. But for internet connection, actually I talked to US government, somebody from NSF, and but they are talking about, okay, because most of resources is in United States, so the United States government does not want to pay the circuit. But if I show this figure, actually that shows it's almost balanced. I believe other countries have facing the similar problem. Later probably, I mean, the information is scattered all over the world. So either, yeah, okay. So that's something, I don't know if anybody from US government, so I can talk to. Okay, we're thinking what we are doing is quite unique because we are educational network, and okay, we can build information resources that the commercial network cannot build at this moment, because for university we have very cheap labor. I mean, students, they like to play with the internet. That's a good thing. Also, we are going to build a Chinese network culture. That's important. Okay, besides Cernet, actually, if you take a look at the APNIC database, there are 190 networks registered under the country code C and the B. Okay, among them, 19 are self-defined as internet service providers. But recently, Chinese government set regulation. They only proved four entities can do internet service as the first tier. Cernet belongs to the China Education State Education Commission, CASNET, which is China Academic of Science Network. ChinaNet belongs to the Ministry of Posts and Telecommunication, and the MENET, which is Ministry of Electronics. The other networks can be the second layer or the third layer or other layers, but only those four entities can connect it to the outside internet. That's the first regulation Chinese government set. So actually now there are two regulations of this kind of thing set by the Chinese government. The first is the safety and the protection regulation of computer information system of People's Republic of China, which is set actually by 1993. And based on this policy, every internet user in China has to register it. Otherwise, it's illegal to use it. Actually, we argue with the people in charge of that, because the internet IID, International Direct Dial Telephone System, actually it's also digital, and it is not required to register it for that. Why internet user has to register it for that? So that's still some argument. And the second is temporary rules of the management of international links of Computer Information Network of People's Republic of China. That's the recent rule. And that's the rule I just mentioned. Only four entities can link to the global internet. So actually, I almost finished. Okay, but I believe...
Well, I'm in the question, too.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Two more figures. Okay. One is... Actually, that's the thing I like to make fun. Like, you can tell Chinese if you know that, and you can see the icons. So there are some kind of similarity or analogy of icons in the Chinese character, because that's graphic user interface. So I always joke, like, the Chinese used graphic user interface thousands of years ago. But anyway... So the Chinese can catch up. Also, another feature. Okay, the last one. Okay, that's the internet prediction chart. Okay, you can find it in the anonymous FTP or the Internet ISOC magazine. And this is the real data. This is predicted data, the connected host and the connected users, internet users, and this part is prediction, and this is the world population, and by prediction, okay, this is the exponential. So by the year 2001, the user of internet will reach the world population. So that's something. But okay, without China, internet cannot reach this goal. Okay, thank you.
Your turn now. Yeah, please.
Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Li has said so much about China, and so because I did some things with the history and the culture of China. because I think one cannot develop his culture without the traditions. Even in the technologies, we have some cultural roots. So my paper is to discuss about the different systems, how the information technologies can change our behaviors and to do with the society. The Chinese have had a long history of thinking miracle cures for society, even since the first Opium War 150 years ago. Since then, thousands of tech methods have been introduced to China. They have indeed changed the living standard of the ordinary people and the attitude to the outside. Due to the problem we all know, such as population growth and poor public and professional education, China lost several chances to develop. Now, there is opportunities for rapid development in China, but the prerequisite is adopting the most advanced technology to leapfrog all the rest of the world, and meanwhile, making comprehensive reform of the society. My point is, only when the government, the enterprise, and the people make a concerted effort can they reach this goal. This focus on collective ideas is different from the Western waves. For example, one may ask, where is the place for individual rights and freedom? I believe that one can compare the individual with the collective ideas in this sense, especially with the tradition of Chinese. We all know within China, there are so many different intentions now. After we open to the world, one cannot treat China as one entity, but the one thing is the constant truth, the optimistic technological determinism, which have heavily influenced by Karl Marx. Can this technology, information technology, change the system of society in China? As a socialist, I don't believe it.
Sociologist.
I'm sorry. I think China needs changes, both in social systems, thoughts, and ideas on the macro life, and the behaviors on the micro life. Both changes from technology and from thought are indispensable. Presently, the social institutions function to use new technology to make people happy and wealthy. The goal of society is for people is in the future, to people to maintain the human integrity, never losing sense of the natural rights unless change is in the future. This gap will never be achieved. The fear of being beaten by the outside world is the strongest motivating force for the successive Chinese government to adopt the newest technology. The virtual internal and external factor which promoted the Chinese conventions with the outside world. This including the open market, the negotiation with the WTO, and its requirements for China as a member. The inner pressure of reduced customs tariffs from the custom, and the day-by-day nature of the national industry and the custom, and the intellectual property protection, such things as that. Indeed, the attitude of the government to the new information technology is very important for Chinese reform and develop. We know that many problems involved in the accomplishment of advanced information society, which cannot be solved unless there are challenges from the perspectives which are free from our existing rules and values. But one cannot, without the transition of his own culture, to achieve an advanced information society, cooperation of the government with the enterprise and the people is indispensable. So I would like to say it is only when these three factors correspond very well can in China will be progress. Otherwise, it is, would be like backward in some world. So my main point is three. One is the China now needs more funds to improve its infrastructures in the heat industry and also the information technologies. The second, I'm asking myself whether the notions like privacy is and something like that is universal or not. The third, can we combine the traditional values with the new emerging challenges, especially for the information technology?
Thank you very much.
I'm going to use the overheads, thinking that you would rather look at some useful information rather than an enormous reproduction of my head. I've been doing research about Chinese and Hong Kong telecommunications development for a few years, and I'd like to put the issue into a broader context, some of the expectations that I think Americans have about the impact of technology, information technology, on the rest of the world is very egocentric and unrealistic. And I'd like to begin by taking a swipe at one of your own here at MIT, Mr. Negroponte, who, to my mind, committed the enormous gaffe of making this statement in Germany at a time when about five or six countries around the world were regulating the Internet, taking steps to regulate the Internet, including the United States and Germany, the place he was in. Now, whatever you think about nation states, they are the building blocks of the international order, and they are the fundamental units of governance in the world today. And this is even more so the case in developing countries like China, which are still struggling with the issue of establishing a stable political order and a continuous cumulative process of economic development and growth. So to them, the nation state is not irrelevant, and this fundamentally affects the way they approach the problems of internet and other forms of communication technology. So one of the philosophical points I want to make is that it's really the system of political economy that shapes the information infrastructure, not the other way around. And the reason we in the U.S. run around believing that technology is autonomous and has determinative power over society is because we have a system of political economy that's based on fairly unregulated market relationships, financial markets, and a liberal democratic political system. And so we give some of these forces a lot of free rein that they don't have in the rest of the world. And we also have a system of values which puts certain kinds of regulation and intervention off base for the government, and that is not the case in many other parts of the world. So let me begin by giving you a very brief and primitive characterization of China's political economy. First of all, China is not like Eastern Europe. They have not decided we're going to become a liberal capitalist society like the West. They are still a communist party, a one-party government that is engaged in a process of socialist reform, which means that they want to introduce market forces into their economy to make it more efficient, but their industrial economy is still dominated by state-owned enterprises and national ministries. So it's and the regime as it currently is constituted does not want to privatize in the sense that they're pursuing this goal in Eastern Europe for a variety of reasons we don't have time to go into. Another thing you'll see is a fairly high level of protection from foreign trade competition in the realm of services. And then particularly the most relevant one here is that in the telecommunications realm, the Ministry of Posts and Telecommunications has prevailed upon the government to prevent any foreign, direct foreign ownership or management of telecommunication services or operations. And of course you have a fairly authoritarian political system. You do have one-party rule. You do have some elections, but they are not of the top leaders. They are of the National People's Congress. And you have the more looming, bigger problem of whether China should be considered a nation state in the sense that France or Germany is a nation state, or whether it is really something more like what the Soviet Union was before it broke up, a very, very, very large collection of different entities under a fairly imperial form of rule. Now, what does this mean with respect to regulation of telecommunications and the internet specifically? There are some fairly positive developments in China, although when you read about them, they may look negative. But what you have is basically an interplay in the Chinese political system between these large state-owned enterprises and ministries competing for economic power, political power, turf among themselves. For a long time, there's been a competition between the Ministry of Posts and Telecommunications and the Ministry of Electronics over who will control the information superhighway. And in 1993 and 1994, the Ministry of Electronics won a big victory by getting authorization to form a competing telecommunications company on a nationwide basis. One of the issues that was unresolved at that time was international competition. Would the new carrier, Unicom, be allowed to participate in international telecommunications markets? With the new internet regulations, one of the things that appears to have happened is that MPT has succeeded in convincing the government that in order to better regulate information content, particularly regarding computer networks, that all international traffic should go through MPT. And I think there's clearly a surveillance rationale for this and to a certain extent an economic control rationale. And as you can see, computer networks are specifically prohibited from doing things that would basically upset the political order. This is not some sort of a day-to-day kind of regulation that the FCC would engage in this country. It's just kind of a reserve clause that allows the government to step in if they feel threatened. Now, one of the most interesting things is this point here, that rather than centralizing all authority over the Internet into one ministry, the new regulations specifically recognize all four of the current players in the Internet. And I think this is a very promising development. That is, it would have been extremely dangerous and perhaps overly restrictive and repressive had they said, had they given it all to the NPT. But we have now a situation of pluralism in Internet governance, so that all of these agencies now have a stake, a recognized stake in the Internet, and all of them can sort of compete with each other for developing the Internet, although within certain parameters. Most of them are still relying on MPT for their basic infrastructure. Of course, all users must register with the Public Security Bureau within 30 days. That was, regulation was promulgated February 1st, so presumably all of those are registered. Now, again, the American tendency is to say, oh, you can't enforce something like that. Well, the most liberal account of the number of Internet users in China that I have heard is 10,000. And in a country that big, when you're dealing with fairly elite institutions and fairly high-level people, you can you're pretty conspicuous if you're an Internet user who's not registered, if somebody wants to go after you. And for a while, I don't know whether this is still true, new accounts were suspended in late January and February, early February. The Ministry of Posts and Telecommunications said that this was being done in order to upgrade the system, but we also know that they were installing some software to filter out pornographic and other kinds of perhaps politically dissident accounts. Now, at the same time this was happening, something similar was happening in the world of foreign financial information. This is my last slide, Gary. Chinese businesses can no longer buy economic news directly from foreign vendors. Now, currently, regular news reports have to go through the Xinhua News Agency, but economic news was exempted from this until January of this year. So they made Xinhua the compulsory intermediary, and this combined economic and political rationales. A lot of the news reports at the time reported, particularly by the Chinese themselves, said that they were trying to prevent attacks on China. And what they mean is that reports of economic activities that could be damaging to the national interests of China. But Xinhua also, of course, benefits economically from having a monopoly over the flow of foreign economic news. So the picture that I would want to leave you with is that when you have a mixed economy, such as is developing in China, you have a combination, a reinforcement of the economic incentives of these state enterprises who can go to the Communist Party members who run the state council, and they can connect their economic interests to the political interests of the people running the Congress. And of course, this goes on in the United States as well. So that they can play upon the paranoia of these people about foreign threats to get them to restrict various kinds of economic activity that also happens to be profitable to or give some kind of a protective monopoly to the state enterprise. And I think the danger of this for the Chinese people is that the reform process and the economic growth process can be slowed down significantly by these kinds of backroom deals, but that the pluralism that is developing in China is a very promising sign, that you see perhaps various kinds of balances of power developing in which different interests are competing with each other all the time, and that over the long term this could develop into some fairly healthy kinds of economic competition. But keep in mind when you're talking about China that it is a very long term we're talking about. Talking about more than 60% of the population really being farmers, talking about less than 20,000 internet users by the most liberal estimates in there now, and we're talking about a telephone penetration rate of about 3% for the country as a whole. Thank you.
finally, we'll have two reports from Hong Kong.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to, I'm going to change the emphasis or the focus slightly here, and the particular line in the statement which I'm to look at is what will happen to civil liberties and privacy expectations in Hong Kong after 1997. And the date there, of course, is the 1st of July 1997, and if you want to go to Hong Kong and book a room at a hotel, I understand they're all booked out. And certainly it's an issue which at least 6.5 million people are intensely concerned about. And Professor Wax next to me will look at the broader aspects of that, the indication that the legislature could be dissolved, that the Bill of Rights could be repealed, and generally set more of the constitutional framework. I want to just look at one aspect, one initiative which I think is pertinent to your own situation, namely Hong Kong's enactment of a comprehensive law protecting personal data in both the public and the private sectors. And I thought I'd just briefly examine the process and hence the dynamics, because you might want to pursue some of these approaches. Now, this initiative was not viewed specifically as a 1997 transition issue. The terms of reference for the Law Reform Commission was signed in 1989. And a committee was established which, apart from perhaps Ray Wax, comprised pillars of the establishment. And that was very helpful because it presented a front to the community of really of the power elite considering and ultimately endorsing these measures. And I was the secretary and did the research and wrote the draft report. Well, the constitutional or the treaty situation in Hong Kong is has some similarities to the US. In particular, it's a party to the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, and as was mentioned recently by a speaker, that is similarly the case in the US. And I think that's pretty important because the International Covenant has a privacy provision in it, and whilst it's rather bold, namely protection against interference in one's private life and correspondence, that has been given a much broader interpretation by the Human Rights Committee, whose province it is to interpret the terms of the International Covenant. And basically, in a general comment that they made, they spelt out that they thought that provision was the basis of comprehensive regulation of at least computerized personal data in both the public and the private sector. And I'd also mention that part of the mechanisms applying to signatories to the International Covenant, and hence to the US, is that regular reports have to be filed with the Human Rights Committee, and I don't know how often that's done in the US, but certainly Hong Kong has had to trot along at the company of the UK, who is actually the signatory to the International Covenant and has applied it to Hong Kong. And the Human Rights Committee has subjected the UK-Hong Kong delegation to very searching probing about the extent to which they have implemented the various provisions of this treaty that they have given their assent to. And presumably that logic and that process should apply equally to the US. And as I say, one aspect of the International Covenant, one obligation really arising from being a signatory to that is protection of personal data in both the public and the private sectors. And this morning we had we had the European approach to things, reference to a European convention, and that provision, the privacy provision in the European Convention, is in very similar terms to that of the International Covenant, and it's the jurisprudence of a European court is directly relevant in construing the provisions of, including the privacy provision of the International Covenant. So all that is, was part of the background to the enactment of the Hong Kong law and remains part of the US's treaty landscape. Now, the way that we proceeded was that we developed a set of very specific proposals, having looked at the laws in other countries, and we had the first draft of the European directive to also to appropriate from. And we put out a very specific and detailed consultation paper to the Hong Kong community. And admittedly, the context was a bit more favorable than perhaps exists here. It does appear that the privacy debate, in, from what I can see in the US, it's partly in reactive mode because of the slew of initiatives instigated by the federal government, which have been discussed at this conference. Possibly that can divert the impetus away from promoting positive new measures, such as a law protecting personal data across the board. We did not have that problem at that stage in Hong Kong. So, what sort of, how did we promote this, these principles, the fair information principles, in an environment which is a hard-nosed commercial and capitalistic one? Well, we emphasized that basically these fair information principles just are good for data quality. Giving people access to their files and a right to correct them will enhance data quality. And we, in fact, the figures which we drew on to show the extent of the data quality problem, we drew were US figures. We drew on David Burnham's book, Rise of a Computer State, and referred to the fact that in one US state, I can't recall which one, was about 22% of criminal history records were accurate and complete. And we hypothesized that it might be on a similar scale in Hong Kong, and of course, there are so many files now on people, between 50 and 300 is the Swedish estimate. So we put the quite rigorous regulatory model to the community, and we got 80 submissions. And from outfits like Citibank and American Express and so forth, only two of these submissions queried the need for such a law. They acquiesced in the need for legal regulation. But they suggest a lot of alterations to the details, to mechanics. They were incorporated in a report released in August 95. And on the 3rd of August, in a report released in August 94, and on the 3rd of August, 1995, we've got two very auspicious numbers there, according to Chinese numerology, maybe 3 and an 8. We had the law enacted. We're now waiting for the Privacy Commissioner to be appointed and the office to set up. Well, what about its implications for the Internet? The law only applies to data users, and we've defined that as only applying to organizations that control the use of data, and we've specifically said that it does not apply to, that a person is not deemed to control data if they're solely using it on behalf of another party, and that was specifically in response to concerns of internet service providers, that they did not want to be deemed as controlling the data just by virtue of the fact they were routing the data. It's only if they start browsing through the data, et cetera, the law applies and they have to comply with data protection principles. Well, what is the China reaction to this? We've received no opposition from China. They were quite vocal in their opposition to a freedom of information law earlier, opposition expressed to a regulation in this area. Indeed, we understand that Jan Fries, former Swedish Data Protection Commissioner, has just claimed his third briefing of officials in China on these laws. So conceivably, we might soon have China with a a law covering both the public and private sector, and then the U.S. really would be in the rear. That is basically all I want to say, to emphasize that this law has emanated in a very pragmatic and commercial sort of environment. Business does, I think, the lesson is, that certainly as far as business is concerned, business is reactive. They're not going to initiate such a move, but if you give them a set of very specific proposals and you argue them persuasively, they will see that it makes good business sense. That is brought out by H.G.F. Smith's book, which came out recently, that basically they realize that it's increasingly a consumer issue. The ambiguity of privacy requires clear norms, and basically that should come from government rather than from business. And of course, Hong Kong has just been joined by Taiwan with such a law. Thank you.
Thank you and good afternoon. I live and work in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is my home. I've lived there for 12 years. The future of Hong Kong is of more than passing academic interest to me and to my wife. The question of privacy is one that has concerned me for some 25 years, almost as long, I think, as Gary Marks. I've written a number of books on the subject, some of which I placed at the back, one of which has disappeared, which I suppose is a compliment of sorts. Americans have generally never heard of me, largely I suspect because what I've written is of probably limited interest and import, but more likely I suspect that academics outside of the U.S. are not taken terribly seriously within the U.S.
Not taken seriously in the U.S. either.
But this is, I once did a web crawler. I inserted my surname on there and came up with Hot Wax, which I believe to be a publication that deals with pirated CDs, tapes, and records. But it is true to say that the extent, and I think this has been brought out in the days of this excellent conference, the extent to which there has been a genuine exchange of views in respect of privacy and data protection between the US on the one hand and Europe and other parts of the world on the other is fairly limited. But all this I say by way of introduction only because what I've been asked to talk about is less the question of privacy, and you'll notice the pronunciation, which poses one of many problems for me, conceptual, philosophical, legal, and otherwise. In Chinese, in fact, I don't believe there is a character that precisely describes the concept of privacy at all. So in Hong Kong, we're doubly in trouble, although I dare say, and this has been one of the themes in my writing, that the concept of privacy in the United States, I've had the temerity to write about American law for a long time, is no more coherent than the concept as it's used elsewhere, but perhaps that's best left unsaid at this stage. Now, 456 days, I think, to go before we rejoin China, before Hong Kong, the sovereignty over Hong Kong, is resumed by the former sovereign, the People's Republic of China. And you've heard from my distinguished colleagues the moves that are being made, fairly rapid moves by any standard, towards greater use of the internet and the greater technological developments that China is moving towards with remarkable speed and efficiency. Now, the people of Hong Kong, as you've already heard, are apprehensive. They are nervous. We lose 1,000 to 2,000 people a week and have done so for several years now, emigrating to the United States, to Canada, and elsewhere. Many, of course, I would hazard that most do not wish to leave Hong Kong, partly because it's one of the most extraordinary places on earth in which to live, partly because it's their home and they like it, and partly because leaving one's home is never an easy or a particularly desirable solution to social or political problems. But that is a fact of life. People are leaving in large numbers, families are split up. The social and economic consequences don't require me to elaborate upon. Should we be concerned? Should we be apprehensive and nervous? Well, the answer to that, of course, if I knew it, and if it weren't as speculative as I'm afraid it is, would obviously supply a degree of consolation and perhaps a degree of support for the people of Hong Kong, such as myself, who face this decision daily. There are, I think, three important points that I want to make in the remaining 5 minutes that I have. Since the joint declaration between China and Britain was signed in 1984 and ratified the following year, the form and shape of the future Special Administrative Region, as we're to be, the SAR, the Hong Kong SAR, became relatively clear. Its principal features, the nature of its economy and legal system, its educational system, its language, its culture, the features that make up Hong Kong were described, identified, and crystallized in the most extraordinary document perhaps ever devised since perhaps the American Constitution to encapsulate the features of a society and to ensure, insofar as law can ever do this, the continuation of the fundamentals of that community. The so-called Basic Law of Hong Kong, which is our constitution in 456 days' time, describes those principal features. And within it, amongst many other things, there is to be found what is generally called, perhaps misleadingly, a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights, Chapter 3 of our Basic Law, specifies a number of individual rights, including the right to privacy, free speech, freedom of movement, freedom of religion, and a plethora of other rights that we generally associate with a democratic, free society. The extent to which one regards that as a sufficient guarantee for our future depends, of course, upon one's interpretation, both of the role of law in society and, I suppose, one's political interpretation of China and the role of the Communist Party within it. The second feature of the Hong Kong system that we had hoped would continue beyond the 1st of July 1997 is our own Bill of Rights Ordinance, a Bill of Rights created by the present sovereign power, the United Kingdom, which is almost verbatim the text of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which reference was made yesterday and again, I think, earlier today, the terms of which again specify both the protection of privacy and of freedom of speech, the two principal rights that I think have been our concern for the last few days. So that is a second limb of the potential protection, although one has to add both that the creation of the Bill of Rights Ordinance was an act neither of altruism nor of goodwill on the part of the British. It was enacted in the shadow, the grim shadow of Tiananmen Square, and the nervousness in Hong Kong, which led to the acknowledgement by the British government that the people of Hong Kong deserved some degree of protection against the possible inroads that could be made into their rights after the resumption of Chinese sovereignty. So this Bill of Rights, which is a curious creature of constitutional law, was enacted in 1991. Chinese government announced definitively some six months ago that the Bill of Rights, which purports to be a superior law against which all existing legislation is to be measured and future legislation as well, a bit of a sort of American-style Supreme Court jurisdiction over the Constitution, would no longer be a superior ordinance. It has therefore been attenuated in a fairly serious way. It will simply be an ordinary law, a bit like the New Zealand Bill of Rights, I suppose. So the extent to which either privacy or freedom of speech, or indeed the other rights that we presently enjoy, will continue after the 1st of July next year is also moot. And finally, the third pillar, or limb, if I'm to continue the metaphor, although I don't want to give the idea that Hong Kong is a three-legged animal, is the common law itself, which traditionally, of course, has provided lawyers, particularly I would argue lawyers in this jurisdiction, with the creative means by which to deploy the principles, long-established principles of the common law to protect individual liberty and human rights. The basic law to which I referred, our future constitution, specifically provides that the common law will continue, whatever that means, for 50 years after the 1st of July 1997. So the combination of the common law, the principles to be found in the Bill of Rights Ordinance, attenuated though they may be, and the basic law, particularly Chapter 3, provide at least some succor, some hope for the continuation of rights after 1997. As a coda, I should say, of course, and I don't need to tell an audience like this, the limitations, excuse me, of legalism or the resistance to the delusion that we should believe that law actually does provide genuine protection is too obvious to be stated. But here we stand on the precipice awaiting our fate. Hopefully it'll be a good one and a desirable one. Thank you.
Very happy to entertain questions from the audience. I hope that in the really admirable spirit of CFP meetings, which above all permits civic and civil discourse among people who may have very different points of view, that we can respect each other. I'd also like to emphasize the fact that our guests from China are here for us to learn from them, perhaps for them to learn from us. They're not here as official representatives of a very complicated and large government. They really are here as individual professional colleagues, and I hope your questions can keep that in mind. Thank you. And please introduce yourself, and let's, to the extent possible, only make little speeches and ask big questions.
My name is Madan Rao. I'm with the IPS News Agency. As an Indian, it's always good for us to find out what our giant neighbor to the northeast is doing. I'm curious as to what kind of dialogue Chinese academics, policymakers, etc., are engaging in with other countries of the region and maybe other countries elsewhere in terms of formulating such policy. For instance, I know that the ministers of information of the ASEAN group meet and discuss regularly to find out regional initiatives to manage information, whether it's from satellite TV or internet, etc. Is China also engaged in similar discussions with neighboring and other countries to formulate internet, etc. policies?
I'm not sorry, I'm not sure, but actually China has some kind of this kind of discussion with neighboring countries like Korea, like Vietnam, probably, and other countries. And last October, there is a conference dealing with information in the Asia Pacific region held in Thailand. And the head of Ministry of Electronics attend that meeting. So that's something maybe.
No,
I actually was Liu Xinghui. Yeah, that's Vice Ministry of Electronics.
Does anyone on the panel wish to respond further? You know, one has a sense that the Chinese authorities are engaged in considerable observation and discussion with Singapore, certainly, and one hears that that is seen as a better model for China by many people than Hong Kong or Tokyo. Sir?
Ross Stapleton Gray, Telediplomacy, Inc. For the last year, I've worked with foreign governments in Washington to get them on the Internet, to get the embassies up. The Embassy of China is on the Internet as of about a couple of weeks ago. If there are 10,000 or so users of the Internet in China, there are clearly a great many more users of the Internet who are Chinese who are not in China, the diaspora. And in the wake of Tiananmen Square, there's a two-volume summary of just a small portion of the Usenet traffic about Tiananmen from Chinese and non-Chinese outside of China and who have gotten news out from facts and relatives and were communicating over the Internet. Clearly, any country with an infrastructure lack who's got a way to go still will have its citizenry scattered all over the world. And I'm wondering if anyone has looked at, studied, or even is encouraging the use of the Internet by the population outside the country, either to aid the country, to return and help build infrastructure, or to aid the country as to use a term from my old profession, agents in place, to help build the country from outside the country. And that's to anyone.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the last part of your question?
Sorry. Well, the question is has anyone looked at the issue of, or is anyone actively promoting the diaspora's use of the Internet and its ability to assist the growth of from outside or to take back to China or to any other country? Yeah.
Well, are you familiar with China News Digest, CND? Yeah, that group is a very active U.S.-Canadian-based organization of Chinese basically graduate students and professors in the United States who have set up, I think every other day a news report goes out to a very large list. They say they have over 35,000 subscribers in the U.S. and Europe and various other parts of the world. And yes, that's the sort of the news organ of the diaspora, and the news service that they offer is extremely professional and fairly unbiased. For example, you can read speeches from, you know, news accounts from dissidents, but you can also read recently some student from Columbia University issued a very interesting criticism of Harry Wu. So it's a very important use of the Internet. And then the Chinese, there's a Chinese language magazine, I can't remember the name of it, Hua
Xiaowenchai.
Hua Xiaowenchai.
Hua Xiaowenchai. News.
Right. Yeah. And that has even more subscribers, right? How many people?
Yeah.
Great. Okay.
If I may add, there's something else called the Overseas Chinese Business Network, which actually talks exactly about what you said, to encourage Chinese businesses around the world to invest back in China.
Thank you.
Good. Actually, you raised a very good question. I can tell, like, CND or this kind of magazine. If the topic is too sensitive during some period, probably we are going to block it or packet filtering. So actually we also, like our professors and the students, also get some mailing list or distributions from outside world, and something is too sensitive. And actually from as a Chinese, especially working for, I mean, developing Internet in China, actually we don't like it. Because definitely Internet, development of Internet in China will help China more open, more involved in the global world. But if somebody send, not our professor subscribe, but somebody just find our professor's email address and send hundreds of copies to them, and that really make the university president nervous. And actually, this kind of behavior will slow down the development of Internet in China. Actually, that's why, like, we for China Education, the research network, actually, I can tell you, we block Playboy.
Would you block Playgirl also?
Actually, we are not really block all of them, but at least the way, that's not our job. That's like the public security bureau or somebody else should give us order because we are technician. We are from technical point of view. However, we block Playboy because it's pretty
famous, and we can show government we have ability to block whatever. If you want us block, we can block. So the government will let us go, so we can continue to do internet development.
This is perhaps with
please.
Yes. This perhaps with the chance transition to do, because in the action to chance, you know, as a conference said, stability of the society is more important if you want to develop. If you want not develop, then non-stability.
Yeah, that is a priority. The reason that China is very concerned about international sources of information coming in an uncontrolled basis is because of the idea of maintaining political stability, which they perceive as the top priority. This, relating back to what Professor Li also said, China is getting itself into a very interesting situation here. And there's a businessman running a China Internet corporation in Hong Kong who said this at a conference I was at in Hong Kong. He says, now look, when you have people say things in the United States, everybody is talking and nobody is listening, so it doesn't make any difference if people say outrageous things. But in China, they're not used to being exposed to anything that's not monitored or vetted by the party, and therefore, if somebody says something, everybody will listen.
Okay, time is moving, and control exists in all society. So let's take the last three questioners, and please be as succinct as is appropriate.
You talked about blocking. Will you block Hong Kong after 1997?
No, actually, we are going to make a link to, okay, now Cernet has only one link to United States, and we are working with HARNET, the Hong Kong Academic Network, to make a direct link between Cernet and HARNET. So, I'm not sure. Yeah, but basically, actually, we set up some BBS bulletin board at Tsinghua University, and a lot of Hong Kongese and the Taiwanese joined. And you know, students, usually they have some kind of fight, but not very political. We just let them go. It's fine. I mean, sometimes I take a look of those bulletin boards, and it's really fun. It's bbs.net.tsinghua.edu.cn, and that can support both GB and Big Five. So you. I think students are pretty smart. They build some conversion.
And I think people within the culture of the West can't walk within the shoes of others and fully understand them. One of the things that shocked me about Beijing recently was that the university, certain T-shirts were blocked, which students were wearing. That even the wearing of a T-shirt was seen as offensive given particular standards. So let's have the last question, please.
Yeah, very briefly, I'd just like to thank you, gentlemen, for coming here and sharing this with us. It's very important for us to know. I think there's a great deal of uncertainty and fear in the Western world about what's happening in China, and we're very, very grateful to you for coming and helping us at least understand some of your information. My question is specifically about the use of cryptography. It's quite obvious from this conference that there's a great deal of control by the United States government about covering the export of cryptography technology from the United States. Can you describe for us very briefly what the import controls are in China for the import of cryptography, and can you also briefly tell us what sort of consequences people in China, particularly academics, might be subject to or suffer from should they come in contact with cryptography and cryptographic materials?
Okay. Actually, at least myself, download PGP international version, and I try to use it. And like, okay. And
if you need any help with that, I run the PGP help team, so feel free to send us email.
Okay.
Unencrypted, of course.
Okay. And I believe other Chinese also do that. And the Public Security Bureau, they ask us. They are thinking probably they want set up some kind of law, like no encryption allowed. But I argued with them. I don't know, it's not very mature, but I argue with them. I said it's not practical, at least from technical point of view, because I can say it's not encryption, it's some kind of compression. Right? Like, you know, JPEG, GIF, and this kind of thing. Also, maybe, okay, you can set only GIF, JPEG, MPEG, and blah, blah, blah. You can use, but, okay, that as an academic researcher, I can develop my own compression schemes. Also, like, I can embed some information into a running program. Okay, you can do whatever you want, right? So I just tell them it's not practical. And I believe they gave up. I don't know, maybe later they are going to do something.
Thank you all very much.